103.2 Dublin City FM. This is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. Good afternoon. Before we start today's programme, I just say that I am absolutely delighted to hear the news that Dubliner Ibrahim Halawi has been found not guilty in an Egyptian court and will be home soon. Absolutely wonderful news. On today's programme, a supporter of Ibrahim, we are going to a conference that was held last Thursday in the Davenport Hotel by Lynn Boylan MEP, and it's all about gambling. That's coming up in a moment, and then we'll go to the Davenport Hotel yesterday, where our microphones were talking to Mental Health Reform about their submission for the review of a Vision for Change. It is Mental Wealth with Brian Green. Do stay tuned. We're at the Davenport Hotel in Dublin, and it's the talk about Ireland. Remove the blinkers. We need to talk about gambling. Joining me is Samantha Thomas from Deakin University in Australia. You're an associate professor there, and you're in the public health area, and you have been doing great things in Australia with regard to regulation of gambling and advertising and things with sport. Can you tell us what wins you've been having over there?
Well, I think for some time now we've seen that this incredible saturation of gambling advertising in sport is really starting to normalise gambling for our kids. 75% of children over the age of 8 think that gambling is a normal or regular part of sport because of the advertising that they see. One of the big wins we've had in Australia recently is that the government has agreed to ban gambling advertising from 5 minutes before the start of a live sporting match till 5 minutes after the end of the match, up until 8:30. At night. What that does is it provides a level of protection so that families can sit down on a Saturday afternoon, watch a game of football without being bombarded by these ads.
There's about $18.5 billion lost in gambling by Australians every year, but the Irish aren't far behind, are they?
No, that's right. Ireland are number 3 in the world for gambling losses, but interestingly, they're number 1 in the world for online losses. So that really suggests that Ireland needs to start to take gambling seriously and do as much as it can to prevent the harm from these products.
For you, what's the number 1 thing we should do?
Oh, I think the number one thing really is around advertising and the restriction of advertising. We have seen in Australia the impact that not only television-based advertising, but the embedding of advertising in sport can have on not only positively shaping the attitudes of children towards gambling, but also in encouraging young men to gamble more than they normally would and on things that they wouldn't normally gamble on. Getting some restrictions around that will be really important.
Deputy Anne Rabbitt, you're given the second panel chairing duties today to talk about gambling in Ireland and the problems. What was the findings, the big takeaway point from this afternoon?
The big thing that was discussed this afternoon was in relation to age and advertising, and I think all panellists agreed, along with most people within the floor, that we need to look at age restriction straight away. We need to look at the watershed hours, and we also need to look at how advertising is done, be it on ordinary TV or be it coming down various forms of social media. And I think we mightn't be able to eat it all in one go, but we should pick our main points, and our main points of today's discussion was age and advertising. Also, what else came up today was in relation to the Gambling Control Bill that has been sitting there since 2013. Not everybody was entirely happy that it's now been diced up into the miscellaneous court bill, and it's only going to be picking certain factors of it. That came apparent as well, and I think there's going to need to be more conversation and discussion around that. But the conversation, the focus was on about child-centred focus, about looking at age and advertising.
I'm with the organiser of today's mini-conference about Ireland, remove the blinkers, we need to talk about gambling. It's Lynn Boylan, MEP for Dublin. How are you doing?
Hiya. Just a long day, but I think a very worthwhile exercise in terms of starting the debate, a long overdue debate in Ireland about why we need to rein in the gambling industry. So I think very useful information, but it's a starting point for something bigger.
What was the genesis? What was that kind of thing that says, I must set this up, I must get more people talking in the great panels that you had today?
Well, I work a lot in dealing with the industry and the failure of self-regulation when it comes to tobacco, alcohol and fatty foods. And when I was working on it, a few individuals came to me and said, you also should look at gambling. And when you started scraping the edge, you realise that actually gambling is a huge problem and it's the one that's not being spoken about. And once you start engaging, even with this conference, the level of interest in the conference was phenomenal, with very little advertising. So we do have, there's a lot of people out there, they're very frustrated because they're working in their own sector trying to get change on gambling, and what we did today was bring all of those together so that we have more strength when we're working together.
Speaking of advertising, and you had little of it for today, but it seems to be the big takeaway thing is do something about advertising. So I'll put it to you that one of our MEPs, Brian Hayes, is trying to do something about advertising. He's trying to take out the terms and conditions that are in radio ads. That's one of his campaigns. What do we need to do with advertising and gambling?
Well, with advertising, we need to have a watershed so that, I mean, one of our speakers was talking about how children as young as 8 years of age can identify betting brands and they associate the, you know, your money back, all of these things. It's a no-lose situation. So we need, first off, definitely that gambling needs to be included in the watershed for advertising that young children would see. The online gambling, it's a harder one to deal with, but it's actually where we really need to focus our energy, because what's happening is people, if they even take a break from gambling online, if they realise, oh, do you know what, I'm going to take a day off, they go into their Facebook, they go into their Twitter account, and up pops advertisements from their online betting company, inducing them back, enticing them back in to gamble. And they get emails with free offers. So we need to put an end to that. I mean, they're the two key things on advertising. The watershed, so children are not being normalised to gambling and sport. And then the second thing is the online gambling and this inducement and the using of people's data where there's clear indications they have a problem and that's being used against them as opposed to being used to help them.
It is said that culture eats strategy for breakfast. If we have a former Taoiseach who was able to explain the monies he got because he backed it on the horses, if Ireland is so embedded in the bloodstock and thoroughbred industry, how can we get a grip on this gambling thing?
Well, I think nobody is saying we want to ban it. Nobody is talking about banning gambling. I mean, we understand there's a lot of people employed even in the bloodstock industry. This is about dealing with the harm that's caused by gambling and that moving the blame from the individual who has a problem to the industry who is irresponsibly targeting those individuals and irresponsibly normalising gambling as an everyday activity. And that's what we need to deal with. And I think it takes, you know, political will and political courage. We do have, of course, vested interests in this country, but in Australia they have a national holiday dedicated to a horse race, and if they can bring in restrictions around gambling, then Ireland can certainly do it.
I'm with author and journalist Declan Lynch. Declan, you've kind of had, if it's fair to say, a love-hate relationship with gambling over the years. You've paid close attention to it for a good long time. You wrote a book in 2009 called Free Money, which tells a bit about your interest in this area.
I was interested, just as a person who has been kind of betting most of my life in a very small kind of scale way, and who, when I moved down the country, opened up an online betting account, which I'd never been aware of before.
For convenience sake.
Yeah, just for convenience sake, because I was living miles away from a betting office and couldn't believe the danger of it and the possibilities inherent in it. Having known, if you like, the old way of gambling, which involved things like having to leave the house, you know, having to maybe cycle into town, you had to do quite a lot of things before you actually could have a bet. Now you could, if I was 18 again, I could, you know, be in my house 24/7. I would not literally have to get out of bed, and I just felt it was far too easy, it's far too dangerous. And I started really thinking about this and writing about it and just about the gambling culture generally in society, which is almost run on the gambling. You know, I mean, the banks, the property, all those issues were inherently about gambling on a kind of large scale. So it's not just, it's a macroeconomic issue and also just individuals who are in great trouble as a result of this. And it's very easy to get into trouble now because of online gambling, the availability of it, the availability of money, without actually having folding monies and so forth. So it's a fascinating issue, and there's so many aspects to it.
You're writing a book at the moment. Is it okay to ask you about that?
Yeah.
And you're writing a book with Tony O'Reilly, who got himself into a lot of bother with gambling and became headline news.
Well, Tony's story just came to me from reading the paper that he had this guy who'd been running a post office in Gorey had gone on the run with a lot of debts, a lot of gambling debts. There was money missing from the post office. He finished up in Carrickfergus. There was a big story for 3 days in the paper. And because I'd been writing about these issues, this is now 2011, I think, and I just thought it was a really perfect example of an individual whose life was completely blown away by this addiction. I wrote about it. There had been a lot of sensationalist kind of nonsense written about the story, and his father contacted the paper because they thought that whatever I had written had shown some understanding of the addiction that he was enduring. So one thing led to another. I made contact. I got to know Tony. He went to jail the sentence was 4 years with one suspended. So I got to know Tony, and the story is so remarkable and so kind of tragic, and yet in the end kind of inspirational, because he came through it and he's an addiction counsellor now and so forth. So I, just as a journalist who'd been writing about that, that was the contact with him, and since then we've been working on the book, and it'll be out next March.
I'll have you back on the show if that's okay.
That'll be delighted to do that, yeah.
Your takeaway point from the whole conference today?
It's good that this has happened. Like I said, I've been writing about this for a crazy amount of time and been increasingly amazed that so little is really being done about it by public representatives, by anyone. So it is great to actually have a bunch of people in the room who know about the thing, who are kind of determined that something should be done. And anything like that has to be good, yeah, because there are a lot of people in trouble with this stuff, you know.
I'm with Paul Buck, CEO or Chief Executive of Epic. You're over from the UK and you've had a wonderful story, a personal story. You've gone on to set up something that is very much a solution to a lot of people's problems that were discussed here today at the conference. Tell us what Epic are involved in.
Okay, so I set up Epic about 3 or 4 years ago with the absolute intention of changing the way that problematic gambling is looked at and gambling-related harm is looked at. So both in the UK, and I think it's true for Ireland as well, you have to have fallen off the edge of a cliff to get any kind of support or help. Now, if you fall off the edge of a cliff with problem gambling, you're generally bankrupt, you've no money left, you've had a relationship breakdown, you've got a criminal conviction in prison, or you may be suicidal or even dead. And that's the brutal truth of this issue. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to put something together where we could stop people getting to the edge of a cliff in the first place. So help them make informed decisions, put some education and awareness programs in the highest risk sectors, and just allow, be it kids or adults in vulnerable sectors, to make good choices, better choices, and stay in control.
I heard today that it's a lot of crisis intervention. It's at crisis when you deal with a gambler, and you want earlier intervention. How are you going to kind of find them earlier?
Okay, so what we'd ideally like to do, if I'm being dead honest, is we want to stop them becoming problem gamblers altogether. So, you know, kids aren't educated at school level about this. They're not educated at any point, really, whereas things like, obviously, sex, stranger danger, alcohol, drugs are all covered. So if people are conscious about the risks of gambling, it's far less likely they will become problem gamblers. If they do, it would be great if everybody in their workplace or anyone in their school could know what to look for. Do some kind of early intervention earlier, and if you're not right long at pathological level at that stage, it's far easier to come back up that cliff than it is if you're right at the bottom, and it is a long way back, because I know that from personal experience.
Bookmakers now are listed on stock exchanges and they're making billions over billions, and they're growing very much because of internet trading and internet books. Is there any stopping them? Are they listening to the downside of their industry?
I think some are and some aren't, from my experience. I think some like to say they are socially responsible and have responsible gambling practices in place, but it's a tick box exercise. I think for others, I think they genuinely do want to intervene with problem gamblers, don't want problem gamblers in their business, and are looking at it far more seriously. So I think it depends sort of company by company, if I'm being honest, from what I've seen.
I'm with Barry Grant of Problem Gambling Ireland, who's here at the conference today. Barry, you mentioned in your slides and in your talk that we're taxing gambling at 1%, and they're ring fencing that money to go back to the dogs and to equine and to horses, and it's not making its way to problem intervention support services. That must be very frustrating.
It is really frustrating. I mean, governments generally don't like ring fencing any funds. They just bring in taxes and then they allocate them the way they would see fit. However, they do ring fence the entire take from betting duty for the Horse Racing and Greyhound Fund. Now, the horse racing and greyhound industries are industries whose sole purpose or whose sole meaning for existence is to perpetuate gambling, to get people to come along and gamble. Like, nobody would go to a horse race if there was not an opportunity to gamble. Same for greyhounds.
You couldn't make it up, but looks like Ireland did.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So I've known concept of why that came about in the first place. You could imagine there were a few vested interests involved there, maybe, but we've been campaigning because the Department of Finance are actually reviewing the betting duty at the moment, and we've met with them and we've sent in a submission to the minister saying that, okay, we've got the lowest betting tax in the world at 1%. In the UK, the equivalent tax is 1.5%. They could increase it by, say, up to 1.1%, and then that additional 5 million is what it would be, could be allocated to addiction services. Now, the CEO of Horse Racing Ireland actually said in an Oireachtas committee meeting earlier this year, when asked the question about that, that it will be eminently sensible. And you have people like Stuart Kenny, one of the co-founders of Paddy Power, writing letters to the Irish Times supporting our suggestion that some of this money would be allocated to addiction services. At the moment, there's no dedicated funding in Ireland for gambling addiction. The HSE don't have it in their service plans, so they don't really recognise it at all, and it's not in the National Suicide Prevention Strategy, despite the fact that it has the highest rate of suicide of any of the addictions.
In a qualitative way rather than a quantitative way, what sort of damage has been done to the people of Ireland, to that small percentage of people who have problems with their gambling?
Massive, massive damage. I mean, if you look at the person with a gambling problem themselves, obviously there's the financial loss, but then there's the mental health issues that go along with that: depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, suicide attempts, criminal activity. And then if you look at the wider knock-on effect of that on the person's parents, partner, children, the family could be losing a house, with a gambling problem could be going to prison. There are all these knock-on effects. Many people with gambling problems will also have substance misuse problems to deal with the stress that's being caused by the gambling. So you've got all these knock-on effects. The gambling industry love this magical figure of 1%, wherever they pull that number out of. But even if it is only 1% of people with a gambling problem, then the research would show that for every one person with a gambling problem, there are 10 additional people affected. So that brings you up to 11% of the population of the country, and that there are no dedicated funded state services to deal with those issues.
We're a small country, but we seem to be the third biggest loser in the world when it comes to gambling and betting, but the biggest loser when it comes to online betting. How can people access your services, or, you know, how can you help people, and where should you point them?
Well, as a starting point, if they go to our website, www.problemgambling.ie, and from there we have two main sections. We have a section for concerned persons. They're about half of the people who would go to the website, so they could be partners, parents, children, therapists, or other concerned persons who themselves don't have a gambling problem but are concerned about somebody in their lives. And we have loads of advice and referrals to other agencies, and they can contact us by phone or by email on their section. Then on the other section, it's for the person with a gambling problem themselves. So again, advice, information on other support services, helplines, our own helpline service, contact by phone or email or Skype or any other way that we can help them. So that would be the main starting point. At the moment, we're a relatively new company. We don't have a lot of resources, so we try and use the limited resources we have to have as big an impact as we can. So a lot of what we're doing at the moment is through outreach, going into schools, We're working with other agencies like Dublin Simon Community, Ballyfermot Local Drug Task Force, and working with their staff to educate them about how to help somebody with a gambling problem or help a family member. So by doing that, we can spread our impact throughout the country with the limited resources that we have.
One final plug then for that website, the all-important one.
Yeah, it's www.problemgambling.ie.
Barry Grant, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My thanks to Lynn Boyle and MEP for organising the Gambling Conference. 4 days later, across the road in the Davenport Hotel, Mental Health Reform were launching their submission on a vision for change.
Kate Mitchell, Senior Policy and Research Officer at Mental Health Reform.
Kate, can you tell us about Vision for Change has been reviewed and you've done a submission with regard to that. Vision for Change 2006, it's been in operation about 11 years and obviously there was a lot of vision. They might have not have done so well on the change side. Would that be fair to say?
I would say that a Vision for Change is a very strong, very positive policy document in terms of providing a framework for reform of Ireland's mental health system. It introduced fundamental principles like recovery and partnership and individuals having choice in their mental health care. It was also usually innovative in that it thought to be a policy for the whole population, not just for mental health services. But there are certainly issues in terms of its implementation. I would say that there was broad-based consensus that its implementation has been incomplete and has been uneven. And certainly I would say that the recommendations set out in A Vision for Change still hold so much value, and A Vision for Change needs to be implemented and realised in full. That being said, there are policy areas that need to be addressed in revised mental health policy that were not addressed in 2006. Examples of that are the need for gender mainstreaming in mental health services, setting out in much clearer detail how the mental health system can deliver culturally sensitive mental health services, the resources required at primary care level to meet mental health needs. And the reality is that we're 11 years on from when A Vision for Change was published, and there are new and emerging issues that need to be addressed. Ireland has a massive homeless crisis that needs to be reflected in revised mental health policy. And there are also changing demographics. We have an increasing youth population, increasing older population that also needs to be reflected in revised mental health policy.
Would it be fair to say that they got some of the big issues like primary care started and they've gone down the road with them, but that in review at this submission stage, 11 years on, that it's a group of very important smaller items that need to be addressed now?
I would say there is a bit of both. There are policy areas that perhaps needed to be teased out a little bit more. One example of that is the mental health support needs of people with both a mental health and addiction, or what we call dual diagnosis. And there needs to be clearer guidance and revised mental health policy in terms of supporting those needs. But there are also policy areas that were missed. For example, the need for a national statutory independent advocacy service for children, the need for gender sensitive mental health services. And there's also a lot more detail required in terms of how primary care can meet the mental health needs of the population. As I said, A Vision for Change was very innovative in that it looked at mental health promotion and well-being of the whole population. But in terms of how that looks and practical details, that needs to be teased out more. One of the recommendations that Mental Health Reform makes in its submission is the need to develop perinatal and early years mental health supports at all levels of the system, from community supports to specialist mental health services.
I'm Sherry McDade, and I'm the director of the National Coalition on Mental Health Reform.
I take it this is not an unsolicited submission, that there is a government department or body that is asking for these submissions, and you're going to step it up a bit and put in the submission. And there's also, I hear, a Doyle committee being formed and an oversight group that's partnering with the Doyle Committee. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, there are really two things happening, one in the government department, the Department of Health, and one in the Oireachtas, which make it really timely for us to have a submission ready to send in. And one is that the review of a vision for change is really due to start, and a group is being established. It's called the Oversight Group, which will organize the review of a vision for change. So we're all ready to feed our submission into that oversight group and really have a significant impact on its work. And then the other thing that's happening quite amazingly is that the Oireachtas has actually established a special committee on the future of mental health care. This has never happened in the history of the Irish state to have a dedicated Oireachtas committee on mental health.
And it's pretty rare internationally, is it?
I think it is quite rare. I don't think it's the very first time that there's been a committee anywhere in the world, as far as I know. There may have been one elsewhere, but it's very, very rare. And it really shows that across the political spectrum that there's a recognition that mental health really needs to be given attention and given an equal status with our physical health. So that's very positive. And again, it's a really good opportunity for us to feed in a consensus view between all our 60 member organizations and people who sit on our advisory groups, people who use mental health services and family members, as to where we think the future of Ireland's mental health system needs to go.
From experience, I know that September through to December in the mental health world is very busy for organisations, but I sense you've got an extra busy couple of months coming up. Tell us about some of the things to look out for.
Well, absolutely. This is the next few weeks are pre-budget time. And so we're very keen to make sure that there's 55 million that could be used to improve the mental health services next year. So we have an active budget campaign, and we would encourage anyone to go onto our website and take action and let your TD or your senator know that you really feel that mental health needs 55 million to be allowed to be spent in next year. We also have very interesting developments in the legislative area in improving Ireland's mental health law. And so we will be active in trying to support Mental Health Amendment Bill put forward by Fianna Fáil, and we think that there's good reason to support this bill, which strengthens the rights of both people who are voluntary patients and people who are involuntary patients when they're in hospital.
You have a couple of websites just to let people know about?
Absolutely. When people want to hear find out any further information about our campaigns or our policy positions, they can go to mentalhealthreform.ie, mentalhealthreform.ie. We do also have a directory of supports from our member organizations, and it's called mentalhelp.ie, mentalhelp.ie.
Sherry McDade, Director of Mental Health Reform, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Always good to talk with you.
You can download the submission at mentalhealthreform.ie. Next week, we go to the International Youth Mental Health Conference at the Clayton Hotel in Dublin 4. That's not to be missed. Until then, thanks for listening to Mental Wealth with myself, Brian Green. Email us, mentalwealth@briangreen.com. Talk to you next Tuesday. Take care. Bye-bye.